Welcome to another tracking series episode of the Wilderness and Wellness Podcast. In this second episode of my tracking series, I delve more specifically into the ways that tracking contributes to human wellness. I talk about humans' evolutionary roots within the cradle of the natural world and how this existence predisposes our bodies, minds, and spirits for more natural ways of being. I make the bold statement that it is my belief that tracking and wildlife tracking specifically is the most effective activity for reconnecting with the natural world and garnering the health and wellness benefits of such a reconnection. I qualify this statement with some reviews of academic theories such as attention restoration theory, the Bar-On model of emotional social intelligence, and the introspective self-analysis that comes from inner tracking with its resulting life inventory that often causes sometimes painful but necessary life upheavals. I weave a few personal tracking stories into the mix for an episode that is sure to offer some insight into the healing power of tracking. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Wilderness and Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, Ron Wallin. This podcast is an exploration of the ways that people can reconnect to the natural world through bushcraft, naturalist skills, and time spent immersed in the nature they find around and within them. We also discuss how this reconnection can increase our individual well-being and that of our communities and the earth. Thank you for joining me. I'm really glad you're here. Hello, friends, and welcome to this episode of the podcast and the second episode in the tracking series. In the first episode, I kind of introduced tracking and gave you kind of an overview of what this series is going to be about. And in this episode, I would like to take some time to set the stage for the rest of the conversations that are going to take place in the series by talking about tracking and human wellness. And of course, the overall theme of the podcast itself is wellness and health and happiness and joy and connection and all those things. And I'm going to go out on a limb and make a pretty bold statement here. And that statement is that I believe that wildlife tracking is the most effective method and potential path for reconnecting with the natural world and obtaining the associated health and wellness benefits of such a reconnection. And I know that's a big statement, but I'm going to attempt to qualify that and hopefully convince you of that in this episode by sharing some interesting stories, sharing some research that has taken place as far as nature reconnection and wellness. And so we're going to have a good time with this topic. So let me kind of start off and set the stage for this discussion by giving you my personal definition of wildlife tracking. And like I said in the first episode for the series, there's as many definitions as there are trackers. And so this isn't, the definition by many other people's standards, but it's a really broad general definition that I came up with mostly for my master's thesis, which I'm working on, which is on wildlife trackers. But I felt that it really applies here. So, like I said, it's pretty broad and all encompassing. And this refers specifically to wildlife tracking. And we are going to talk about some man tracking and things of that nature in this series as well. But as far as the nature connective, wellness, health and wellness benefits, I want to focus more on the wildlife tracking side of things because it is, when one is wildlife tracking specifically, they're out there for the specific purpose of connecting with the natural world. Not that you don't get some benefits of that with man tracking, but, just want to kind of throw that out there. So, for purposes of this discussion, this episode, we're going to use the term wildlife tracking, and that refers to the holistic practice of nature observation and awareness, including but not limited to various activities such as wildlife track and sign identification, trailing, bird and mammal language, which is interpreting baseline animal behaviors and the vocalizations and deviations from them, observing the patterns of the weather, seasons, celestial movements, vegetation cycles and identification, and all other activities that help the tracker gain a better understanding of an ecosystem and its parts. again, I know that's like a catch-all definition, but that's kind of the reality of what tracking is it is a catch-all. When one is out tracking, they're taking in information from everything. You know, if a good tracker is someone who is a good trained tracker or is attempting to get there and learning tracking skills, they're working on these sensory awareness and perception exercises that are really all encompassing of all things, noticing patterns in the natural world. So while tracking is looking at tracks on the ground, following the tracks of animals and all that, it's so much more. When we talk about holistic tracking, we're taking in information from everywhere. And that requires not only a very, very deep knowledge of place and of vegetation patterns, and not just of the animal that one is tracking, but all the other animals around it. Again, the seasons, all these things come into play when one is trying to track an animal, whether they're just identifying something and trying to figure out the story behind it or actually following that animal, trailing that animal, all these different things come in. And so one is truly immersing themselves, their senses, and being in the moment in the natural world when they're tracking. So how does this relate to optimal human health and wellness? Well, for that, we have to consider our evolutionary history as human beings. As human beings, our ancestry goes back hundreds of thousands, even millions of years, evolutionarily speaking. And for the vast majority, you know, greater than 99% of that time, we did not live a modern agricultural industrial existence. We lived in direct relation with the natural world, being raised in the cradle of nature, really. And even then, we didn't call it nature. It just was it. And we were a part of it. And it was us and we were it. And we were in it. And we were living on the land. We were hunting our food. We were paying attention to the weather patterns and the seasons to know when, you know, these particular berries were going to come out, or when this particular tuber would be good to eat. And when the seasonal migrations of the antelope or whatever species of game it was going to be coming through. We were intimately tied and connected to the rhythms of the natural world, and it was part of us and we were part of it. And that's how we evolved. We were tied to it. Our DNA was literally physiologically shaped by these forces of the natural world. And again, we were just intimately tied to it. And so our bodies still expect those things, our DNA, our brains, our minds, because we evolved living this type of lifestyle, we still expect that. We expect to interact with the natural world in those ways. We expect to interact with our family members and our social relations in those ways as well. But we no longer do that because in this very, very short period of time of what we call modern history, modern recorded history, we have drastically changed the way we live. And evolution has not caught up with that. Biological evolution has not caught up with looking at screens and driving really fast and communicating with people in vast distances and not having that face-to-face touch type of relationship with most people that are, you know, within our sphere. And so we're living a completely different lifestyle than our bodies and our minds were designed for. And so it makes sense that if we're able to reincorporate aspects of, you know, that old type of existence, or old, you know, that original type of existence is a better word for it, then we will be more healthy because we will be meeting our body, our mind, our brain's expectations of what it needs. And John Young talked about this as being ergonomic. What is ergonomic for the human body? And really that just means is what is most natural for us as humans? What way of being, what way of eating, what way of moving, what way of interacting, what type of cultural situation is best and most healthy and most beneficial for the human body. And of course, if we were able to go back and live as hunter-gatherers, that we would be able to have those things, that we would be doing things that were more healthy for us and our minds and our bodies. Because we're not in that situation, and living these modern lives, we have to do things that will be able to bring us back to that, to bring us those health and wellness benefits. And that's what this podcast has been all about, is reconnecting with the natural world, reconnecting with our roots, reconnecting with the source of who we are. You know, we are nature and it is us. And I cannot think of any activity out in nature that connects us more closely and helps us to be within the natural world in a way that is more ergonomic, more evolutionarily speaking, right, than wildlife tracking. You know, there's many activities that one could take part in within the natural world. One can go mountain biking, one can go rock climbing, one can go canoeing or kayaking, four-wheeling, you know, all these different things, backpacking that one can do, even bushcrafting and all these. One can do all these different things in the natural world, and one will gain health and wellness benefits from that. But the research shows that the greatest health and wellness benefits come from being in nature and using it not just as a wallpaper, not just as a background for a fun activity, but being in the natural world and interacting with it for the sake of being with it and interacting with it, being there because we want to connect with nature itself. Those kinds of activities bring the most health and wellness benefits. Activities such as birding, you know, looking for insects or things of that nature. What activity encompasses so many different ways of interacting directly with the natural world more than wildlife tracking? I cannot think of one. Maybe there is one. Maybe there's something out there. But because of the all-encompassing nature of tracking, it to me just screams of an amazing way to reconnect with the natural world for the health and wellness benefits. And of course, that's not necessarily why we do it. When people get out and track, they do it because they love it. It feels good. It feels nice. One's able to connect with other beings, other animals. One's able to see the deeper mysteries and the stories in the natural world. And it's just plain fun. But we also get the health and wellness benefits, in the midst of that fun. And again, I can't think of another activity that is more connecting and thus able to give us more health and wellness benefits than tracking. So let's move into a little bit of kind of the research and the theoretical bases upon which I'm building this case. And I guess before I go into that, I will just speak to the fact that there are many ways to know the world. There are many ways to experience the phenomenon of living in this dimension, in this universe. And culturally speaking, the way that the Western world tries to qualify the lived experience quite often is through scientific inquiry, research, of that modern Western bent. And so, because that's what I'm most familiar with, maybe not most familiar with, but more familiar with, especially as I'm continuing to pursue my master's degree. That's the chief method with which I'm going to use to discuss these things. And so I'm going to go ahead and start this section out with a bit of a story. And this story is a personal experience that I had, and it's one that finds me at my sit spot. So I had a sit spot in an area on the Colorado Plateau in the high desert of Arizona, about 4,300 feet, just below what people call the Pinon Juniper Zone. And this area is pretty characteristic of Navajo sandstone with sagebrush and all that. And my sit spot at this time, this area that I was at, didn't really have any water features or anything like that. And it was pretty near a town. And so there was a lot of human activity in the area. There was a lot of sandy roads going in and out where people would drive their four-wheel drive vehicles and off-road vehicles and whatnot. And there was also a lot of animal activity in this area, particularly with birds, lizards, and coyotes especially. And so it was a neat area to view the interaction between the modern human world, so to speak, and the animal world. And so I was sitting there one evening at my sit spot, just, you know, admiring things, trying to be in the moment. And a vehicle went by. It was a kind of an older Suburban, and it went by a road, you know, probably, I don't know, 50 yards in front of me, and continued to drive by and went back towards the north of me, probably about several hundred yards north of me, and stopped. And, the occupants, which were multiple, probably four or five teenage boys, got out and, were doing their thing, whatever. And I just sat there, continuing to enjoy the desert landscape and be in the moment and watch the birds and all that. And I started to hear this really intense alarm call coming from a bird about, 30 yards just north of me. And I turned to look, and it was a rock wren. And it was really, you know, going pretty intensely on this kind of rapid call. And I took that as an alarm call. It was something I could kind of feel inside my body. I could feel the intensity of the call, that something was wrong. This bird was worried about something. And in my mind, I kind of thought for a moment, what is it alarming at? And the only thing that I could think of in the area was those young men who were, you know, several hundred yards north of us. But it didn't make sense to me, the timing of it, because those young men had already been there for a few minutes. I had already driven past, had been there for a few minutes. And so I started to think, there's got to be something else going on here. And sure enough, as soon as I had that thought, a coyote popped up from in between a couple of sand dunes, and was in an intense mood as well. And it kept looking back at those young men and what had happened, after kind of retracing what I saw, was that the young men who got out were in that area actually flushed this coyote out and kind of pushed it out. And of course, the flushing of the coyote brought in the rock wren, who was pretty concerned about the situation. And so we see this concentric ring of disturbance that was created by these young men in this area. And that was just really fascinating to me as someone at the time who was still trying to learn and understand bird language and things of this nature. And I just really, really enjoyed that experience. You know, I got to really connect with the land. I got to connect with this little bird and then the coyote, after which, I saw the coyote. I watched it for a couple minutes because, you know, this was a pretty open area. I watched it move away in the direction it moved. And then I was able to go after that and go track that coyote. I spent about another 30 minutes or so, was all the time I had tracking this coyote and trying to recall what it was doing when it looked back towards the young men and all that, and see that story in the tracks as it went. And so it was just a really, really neat opportunity to connect with these animals, to see how they reacted to each other, how they reacted to the people in this situation. And it was just a really neat overall experience for me as a budding bird language and tracking student. And so now I'd like to relate this story to, a theory that's been put out about the natural world and how it helps our brains and our minds to be more healthy. And this theory that was developed is called attention restoration theory. And essentially it suggests that the ability to concentrate might be restored by time spent in natural environments. So kind of in a nutshell, the theory goes into these different types of attention that we as human beings give to the world around us. And more specifically, it outlines two types of attention. The first is directed or voluntary attention, and the second is indirect or involuntary attention. So directed attention refers to activities such as like writing a paper, editing a video, reading a book, different activities that require higher order mental functions. And this type of attention is finite. It takes a lot of resources from our brain and our focus and attention to be able to do this. And essentially, this cannot be maintained indefinitely because fatigue eventually sets in. You know, all of us at some point in time understand what this is like, whether we're cramming for a test or, you know, what trying to meet a deadline with a presentation we're developing, whatever. We get to this point where we just so saturate our mind that we just, our minds just turn it, you know, I've heard the expression and felt like my mind has turned to mush. And to me, that's a great example of this finite ability of our brains to be able to use and maintain directed attention. So this resulting fatigue from our brains from using this directed attention is associated with poor decision making, lower self-control, high stress and anxiety, and, you know, the accompanying associated poor health issues that can result. So we see this a lot in our society, in our world. We see it in our social environment. More specifically, this kind of attention is exemplified in a lot of the screen time that we engage in our modern day society, especially when it comes to social media, watching videos and things of that nature. And so we see this and we see the poor mental health effects that come from this. So that's directed attention. The second type of attention that attention restoration theory discusses is what's called involuntary or indirect attention. And this kind of attention is what they term like a soft fascination, such as watching a bird feeder or walking through the woods. You know, it's attention, but it's attention that involves almost an effortless ability to be aware of something or something that's drawing our attention. And this is that soft fascination piece, you know, something that allows for reflection, something that, you know, it's like we're not going after it. We're not really directing our attention at it. We're just kind of being present and allowing things to draw our attention. So that is the involuntary or indirect attention. And engaging with nature in this way it's a more simpler attentional process. It requires less demand on our cognitive resources. And in this way, it doesn't overstress our brain. So with the directed attention, it creates that stress on our brain. And in order for us to be able to do that again, to have that directed attention, to be able to focus on something, we need a period of recovery. Our minds need time to kind of reset, if you will. With involuntary attention, however, or indirect attention, there is no need for recovery. And in fact, involuntary attention actually is the recovery mechanism to help our brains overcome the stress that it gets from the directed attention. So I know I went over that kind of quick and bounced around a bit. So I hope that that everyone got that. I'll just re-summarize. So real quick, there's direct attention, which is focused attention, which creates a strain on our mental and cognitive resources and requires a period of rest in order to get back to a good functioning brain. And then you have the involuntary or indirect attention, which is more of a soft fascination, such as watching a bird at a feeder or walking through the woods or having something draw our attention. It's also called a soft fascination. And this, not only does it not require a restoration period because it doesn't drain our cognitive resources, but it actually helps to restore our brain from the other directed attention. So the actual theory of attention restoration, which of course is what we're talking about here, proposes that time spent in nature away from the demands for direct attention encourages involuntary attention, which we all know, of course, by spending time in the outdoors, and that such involuntary attention enables the brain to recover, to restore, and helps us basically to reap the cognitive benefits of a brain that is not constantly in a state of stress. One study about this particular phenomenon found that the prevalence of vegetative cover and abundant afternoon bird activity were associated with lower instances of stress, anxiety, and depression. you know, that shouldn't be a big surprise to us who spend a lot of time outdoors. And for those who don't get to spend a lot of time outdoors, this is kind of a good indication of why you should start doing that. And of course, for me, this sit spot experience that I had, you know, this was the first time that I really started to incorporate a sit spot. And during this time period of my life, I started really, really finding that I was able to be more focused at work. I was able to have more presence of mind when I was with my loved ones because I was spending a good amount of time at my sit spot. I was getting, and of course, I didn't know it at the time, but while I was doing this, as I was having these experiences with these animals, as I was sitting there practicing sensory awareness exercises, I was getting that soft fascination. I was getting that attention restoration for my brain. And it was allowing me to have that presence, allowing me to have more cognitive resources because it was resetting my brain in a way and giving me that rest that I need. And so to me, this is a good model for understanding why I was able to have reduced stress, why I was able to be able to have more mental and cognitive resources available for my loved ones around me and also for my work. I could be more focused. I could be more engaged because I was getting those restorative benefits. And perhaps pointing out the obvious, this isn't to say that tracking can't be a directed attention focused activity, because it, you know, as all trackers know, it definitely certainly can be. However, I find that even when I am having directed attention, which I try not to do, because as a tracker, one of the important aspects and skills to try to develop as a tracker is, yes, to give your attention, to look at the track, to try to study it and find the tracks and the trails and the little nuances that give us more information, but also to have that open listening ear at all times, not only to be able to listen to the bird language, to know what's going on, to be able to pick up more information that might not just be in that track, but also, especially for those who are tracking in places like Africa and places where there are real dangers, that is an absolute necessity. As any of trackers who've tracked there know, there are animals that will kill and eat you. So listening to that bird language is not just important for understanding the whole story, but it's really important to preserve one's life in some cases. So that's a key skill. So being able to develop that ability to have focus, but to constantly go in and out of that overall awareness is really important, and I think can counteract that really directed focused attention that one may get even when they are tracking. So that's just one, you know, model or way of thinking or applying a theory about nature and its ability to help us mentally to tracking. Another one that I'm going to talk about now has to do with emotional intelligence. So more specifically, I'm referring to what's called the Barr-Ahn model of emotional social intelligence. And just a quick definition of that is that this is an array of interrelated emotional and social competencies and skills that determine how effectively individuals understand and express themselves, understand others and relate with them, and cope with daily demands, challenges, and pressures. So something very similar to what I was talking about earlier as far as my ability to be able to deal with the daily challenges and relationship and things of that nature that was going on, and how I felt attention restoration was one model to be able to explain why I was able to do that better. And this is just another. So one study, you know, talking about this model, found that adolescents who spent time in nature during like an adventure therapy course gained a marked improvement in overall emotional social intelligence. And one of the things that they really mentioned with this particular model of understanding things and one mark of mature emotional intelligence is empathy. And according to one study that was done among 90 schools in Melbourne, Australia, showed that access to nature was responsible for many emotive benefits, including the ability to cooperate with others and concern for other living things. Further research highlighted that the idea that people's interactions with and attitudes towards animals are predictive of human-to-human empathy. Essentially, if the way that humans treat animals is going to be similar to the way that humans will treat each other. And of course, as trackers, we're constantly interacting, maybe not directly as we would with a pet, but certainly emotionally and empathetically interacting with other animals as we track them and as we spend time learning about them and their behavior, whether it is directly through tracking or wildlife viewing, or even reading about them in a book and you know, studying in that nature. And beyond being predictive of empathy with this, you know, attitudes towards animals and extrapolating that towards humans, some programs have begun instituting using animals to teach pro-social messages to adolescents with success in altering students' level of empathy. That was from a study from 2008. So we can see that, you know, relating to the natural world in general, and especially to animals in particular, has a real strong transference in our ability to properly relate to our fellow human beings. I would imagine, especially those that are closest to us. And that's, I'd like to make a point real quick here on human wellness. I think when we talk about health and wellness, we often think about our own personal wellness, you know, kind of like contained in a bubble, like, you know, my body, my mind, my this, my that. And I think, at least I don't often consider that wellness has a lot to do with my social connections as well. You know, I can be all well and good in my body and in my spirit and in my mind. But if I'm not well in my social relationships, especially with those closest to me, how well can I really be, especially in my spirit and in my mind? Those emotional relationships are a key aspect of being a human being on this earth. And, you know, as we're seeing, and this totally relates to what I was talking to earlier about, you know, how we came up, evolutionarily speaking, in our prehistory as human beings, we were in social groups. We were connected to community 100% of the time. So it totally makes sense that spending time in the natural world, as we would have been back then, helps and adds value to our ability to better relate to other people, which we would have been doing all the time back then anyways. So it's just this really vast, big, interconnected idea of time in nature is healthy for our minds, our bodies, our spirits, our social relationships with communities, and of course, our ability to have this love and appreciation and desire for stewardship towards the earth and the natural places that we spend time in. So continuing just a little bit more on this, you know, social emotional intelligence, there was another research effort that utilized four different studies to determine the effects of nature immersion on intrinsic aspirations and generosity. All four of these studies showed that when the participants were exposed to and immersed in nature in some way, whether through photographs or the presence of natural beings such as plants, they all responded with more pro-social altruistic behavior. Now, these were, you know, just the presence of these plants and maybe not always in a natural space and just photographs of these things. Imagine how, you know, just the immersive experience of tracking, regardless of the specific activity one is doing, whether it's a sit spot, whether one's actually out trailing animals, whether one is doing conservation work, collecting data, you know, all these different things, being out in the natural world in this very, very intimate and interactive way, how can it not be, you know, such have more of a stronger effect than even what this study showed that was just using photographs in the presence of natural beings to help improve more pro-social and altruistic behavior. And just anecdotally, being in the tracking community and having spent time having some really in-depth discussions with other trackers as part of my research for my thesis, my master's thesis, I can totally attest to a lot of this, these findings of these different studies when it comes to trackers specifically. I would be hard-pressed to find another group of people that was as compassionate and pro-social, altruistic, very, very self-reflective, and the list goes on and on and on. And I'll talk about that a little more later, but I just have to say, trackers in general are just wonderful, wonderful people. The salt of the earth type of people that you would want to surround yourself with, because it just makes you want to be a better person. That's been my experience. I can only speak from my personal experience, and that's what I have experienced and seen so far. And so for this next section, I'd like to really touch on inner tracking, because that's a super, super important aspect of wellness, is one's relationship with their self. And I'd like to do so by kind of reading a bit of a journal entry that I made regarding an experience that I had. And so I'll go ahead and do that. I'm following a trail, marking each track with a wooden stick as I go. The tracking was fairly easygoing for the first 30 yards or so. Pug marks clearly discernible in the glittering sands of this southern Sierra Pinon forest, bordered with sagebrush. Now the trail is moving into the more wooded part of the forest, where the ground is covered with pine needles. Not a great substrate for seeing tracks easily. I am on assignment. This is the last exercise in the 5-day intensive tracking course that I am attending. My charge is to find a trail I feel called to follow, connect with the animal by asking its permission, commit not to give up even if I lose the trail, and learn what I can. I started by wandering, asking to be guided to the animal that was meant to teach me. I felt pulled in a direction and distance far away from camp, where the sagebrush meets the forest. Once there, I came upon some black bear tracks, perhaps 4 to 5 days old. I put one hand over one of the tracks, asking if this was my trail and gaining permission to follow. I explained to the bear my desire to follow its trail to see what I could learn, and expressed my commitment to stick with the trail for the time that I had, no matter what. I received an answer in the affirmative. I began trailing in earnest. While trailing, other things were gently bubbling just under the surface of my mind, though I could not pinpoint them at the time. Looking back, I can say that I was struck by this method of finding them moving forward with the task at hand. It was a method I had never used before while tracking in the previous 3 years. It was a method that stirred something in me. I continued on the trail. The bear moves through downed logs and patches of pine needles, turning the logs over, probably in search of grubs or other tasty morsels. I get thrown off the trail a bit as the bear moves straight towards a thick of trees. I hit a wall. A wall is a place where the tracker loses the trail, and it is here where the tracker learns the most about their skills and about themselves. I was committed by my instructors to, quote, never leave a trail when you are at a wall. If you must leave, do so while you are on the trail, end quote. The same could be said for life. When I hit a wall, how do I react? Do I give up, defeated, or do I give it my all and continue to persevere, picking up nuggets of wisdom and strength along the way? Such introspective questions seemed to come naturally as I followed the bear trail. Aha! There is the track, I say to myself, as I put the side of my face against the ground, trying to get a new perspective on the trail. Having pushed through this wall, I move on. The patches of sand intermixed with pinon needles make it difficult, and I quickly hit another wall. This one takes longer, but using different sight perspectives helps me eventually find the next track, and I'm back on the trail. This goes on for another 30 minutes or so as I tediously follow the bear track by track. Then I hit the wall of walls. the one that is to be my true test of commitment. I try every trick I have learned. I vary my visual perspective, measure the stride to try to determine the approximate location of the next footfall. I try to put on the mind of the bear, getting on all fours, walking the length of the trail thus far, huffing and sniffing around. Still, no luck. It is getting late, and it's time to go. But I refuse to give up. I radio my instructor to let him know that I need more time. He acquiesces to my request. Why am I unable to find the next track? Then I remember a tip I heard about being able to palpably feel a track underneath pine needles. I go to the last track that I found and feel around on the needles in front of it. There it is! Sometimes the answer is right there, simple and easy, but requires some creative thinking and a little grit to realize fully. There's absolutely no visual indication of a track on the dry, crispy, light brown pine needles, but I feel a noticeable depression, the same size as the previous tracks. Then I feel in front of this one. There is the next, then another, and another. With this new tool, I can continue better than I had before. I am back on the trail. Such has also been the case in life, as I pick up new tools for solving problems with my behavior, thoughts, and decisions with my family, work, and all other aspects of life and relationships. I give thanks for this gift that the bear has given me, the gift of perception on a seemingly imperceptible substrate, in tracking and in life. I make an offering of sage, wishing the bear well on his life journey, and depart humbled, content, and with a better understanding of self than I previously had. So, you know, as you could tell, this story, this journal entry of mine, is really kind of my first experience, one, trailing a bear, which was really fantastic and amazing. Two, being able to track in an empathetic way, you know, searching myself and really talking to the animal, even though it wasn't there. And that was a really fantastic experience for me. And later, as I continue to ponder on this experience and learn more about and think about inner tracking, I was able to really see how these two things interrelated, and how tracking a bear can really be a vehicle and a conduit for me to be able to track myself. So, you know, I touched on it in the last episode, but just to kind of reiterate what inner tracking is. Inner tracking refers to this way in which a tracker turns inward with self-contemplation and introspection. And there's a really, really great paper produced by David Kowalewski, and I hope I pronounced his last name right. And it's called Metaphysical Tracking, the Oldest Eco-Psychology. You can find it online. I'll put the link for it in the show notes. And it's a really fantastic paper, just documenting and talking about various, you know, metaphysical experiences that can be found in the anthropological literature and other places, and also personal accounts of metaphysical experiences. And, you know, one might not necessarily call inner tracking metaphysical, but he does have a section talking about inner tracking, and it's a really fantastic section. And, you know, he really kind of has some really great quotes in there. And he says, the experience of tracking often results in psycho-spiritual transformation of the deepest kind in the soul of the tracker. Trackers often undergo a metamorphosis resulting in substantial life changes. And this is also something that John Young talks about, how often when people really, really start getting into tracking, all of a sudden they have this real kind of life perspective shift, and they start doing what might be considered odd things. You know, they start quitting jobs and spending a lot more time in the woods and doing this, you know, these what might seem to other people crazy things. But when one understands tracking in general and inner tracking specifically, it becomes more clear what's happening. Kowalewski goes on to talk about, he believes the key lies in the energetics of tracking. When a tracker follows tracks long enough, he or she begins to follow the metaphysical tracks as much as or even more than the physical ones. The trail of the animal becomes a metaphor for the life path of the tracker. And when tracking metaphysically in this way, the energy of the tracker intertwines with the energy of the tracked. And before long, unsurprisingly, one begins to track one's own energy, one's inscape, and eventually to compile an energy audit of one's life. In short, one starts to track oneself. And I definitely saw this as I really began tracking more and, spending more time trying to learn this art and skill and practice it myself. It was really, for me, a personal perspective shift in life. I started looking at things differently, thinking about things differently, really looking within more and asking questions of myself. And at first, I didn't even realize it. But the more I got into it, the more I started delving into this idea of inner tracking, the more apparent it became to me that this was what was going on. And, you know, as far as the wellness aspects of this, at first it might seem that it's not necessarily a wellness thing at all, because when one starts tracking oneself and engaging, questioning oneself in this way, things start to become upended. And by that, I mean, people start realizing the patterns that they've lived with throughout their life. And often the ones that come to the surface the soonest are the unhealthy patterns that one has engaged in. And when these start to come up, a desire to change them starts to come up as well. And at first, the actions towards changing these things might seem anything other than wellness and improving one's life. But I like to think of it like the junk drawer. Like, we all have a junk drawer, right, in our house, somewhere where just kind of the random odds and ends stuff gets thrown. And I like to think of that like, you know, the unhealthy things that we slowly add to our lives, and they just kind of sit there and don't get dealt with. And like the junk drawer, eventually it starts overfilling with stuff to the point where you can't close it. Things start really becoming noticeably wrong in our lives. Things aren't working the way they're supposed to. And eventually we have to clean out that junk drawer, right? Well, cleaning out the junk drawer involves really taking everything out and dumping it out on the counter or whatever, you know, however it is we do it, and sorting through, throwing away the stuff we don't need, putting in order or putting away elsewhere the things we do want to keep and need, and really just organizing it. And that act of dumping things out seems like it's, you know, a lot of messy stuff. And that's what it feels like in our lives too, when we start to dump out the junk drawer of our lives and start to sort through things. It feels really messy, but the end goal and the end result is more alignment with our purpose, more alignment with who we are, what we want to do, what our goals and passions and visions are in life. And so in a very real way, this inner tracking and this perspective shift that comes up and starts to change the way that we live life is ultimately much more in alignment with what I believe, at least for me personally, is much more in alignment with my own inner desires, inner vision, inner passion, inner goals in life, and also what I feel, the universe wants of me, what I feel my life purpose is. And so that's a really, really important aspect of tracking, at least has been for me personally, that I found a lot of wellness in my life. And just another real quick word on inner tracking, you know, another aspect of how wildlife tracking can lead to this inner tracking, and one which we've already talked about a little bit, though, is the empathy that one gains for the wildlife that are tracked. So when a tracker focuses on an animal, especially using biomimicry, you know, putting her or himself in the mind of the animal, one tends to leave behind the self. You know, when we start to take on the thoughts and the behaviors and whatever of the animal while we're tracking it to try to gain more perspective, we kill the ego. And the ego is that part of us that we often try to identify as us, even though it really isn't us. But when that ego is dead or even lessened, there's a chance that the big self, the real self, the being, will come visiting. And another work by Conessa Sevilla, There's a quote that says, "There's a chance that the big self will come visiting wearing a coyote, fox, or a wolf mask dancing." And continues to say, "The tracks are normally the means to a kill or for setting a clever trap. But the killing that counts is putting out of its misery the distorted ego. And the trap is for capturing defunct personas acquired during an over-civilized and pampered life. Thus, a tracker that tracks holistically and intuitively eventually ends up tracking her or himself, a sometimes painful yet necessary journey of self-discovery and self-awareness, which undoubtedly leads to more happiness if the tracker does not turn off the trail." And I think that's a great way to end the section on inner tracking. It's just a difficult but wonderful aspect of tracking. And I've sure appreciated it in my life. Just kind of in closing, as I've traveled this trail of self-awareness, self-discovery, and healing of mind, body, spirit, relationships, all these things, and tracking has definitely been a big part of that. You know, I've met many aspects of myself that I'm proud and that I embrace, and I've also met some aspects of myself with which I wrestle, and with which I need to work as well. Tracking has given me the awareness, the perspective, and the tools for this life journey that I didn't previously have. And because of these tools and because of this practice, I've been happier. I've been able to improve in all the various roles in my life personally. In my role at work, in my role with family and friends, and my own personal visions and desires and gifts and all those kinds of things. So I'm super, super grateful for this art and skill, this practice that has helped me look beyond myself by looking within myself. In a society that's so obsessed with the advance of self through material wealth, through the gaining of power, through the taking advantage of other people, all these different things, how refreshing would it be for more people to measure their advance of self within this society through the quality of their interactions with others as guided by their awareness of self and how the ego does not always serve them. Wildlife tracking offers an avenue for this kind of introspection and the wellness benefits that surely follow. And again, I'm just so grateful for this practice that I have learned, that has become a part of me, that has given me a new community of family and friend, chosen family and friends with which I can interact, that we can have this common language, that we can have this common understanding, that we can touch something deep and rooted within ourselves, something that is a part of ourselves, something that's so familiar about just this process of being human, and just super grateful for that and humbled by the amazing people within this community that are so free with their knowledge, and it's just been really amazing, and I'm really excited to share with you a lot of that knowledge from the discussions that I've had with many people in this community. And so I hope you really, really enjoy this series, because I've really enjoyed putting it together, and it has really impacted me in a positive way, as I hope it will you. As always, feel free to go and leave a review. Tell me what you think. You know, I post these episodes on social media, especially with Facebook and Instagram. Please come on, start a conversation. Let me know what you think. If you have thoughts, these are just a few little theories and ideas and things that I've come across as I've researched and studied these things. And there's as many personal experiences on this stuff out there as there are trackers. And there's certainly many more ideas and theories and things. These are just a few. So I'm just barely scratching the surface. But again, I really, really feel that wildlife tracking is an especially effective and potent way of gaining the health and wellness benefits that come from spending time in the natural world. And So with that, I'll close. And thank you, as always, for coming along on this journey. I hope to see you online with reviews. Again, as always, please send me an email. If you have any questions or any additions or whatever, you can send that to ron@coyotespath.com. You can interact with me on Facebook, on Instagram. We love reviews. We love shares. And I'll leave it at that. We'll see you on the trail and in the next episode.